Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Christy Rosa. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to Milwaukee, Wisconsin for State of the Science Summit on Breast Cancer. At the meeting, faculty from Carbone Cancer Center of the University of Wisconsin highlighted the evolving paradigms across breast cancer subtypes and settings, such as early and advanced hormone receptor positive breast cancer, early-stage HER2-positive breast cancer, and metastatic triple-negative breast cancer. Additionally, there was an intriguing discussion on the use of precision medicine approaches with blood-based markers, which are being evaluated to better predict response to treatment and identify risk factors in patients. This is what we discussed with Mark E. Burkard, MD, PhD, an associate professor of medicine in the hematology-oncology section of the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, and a member of the UW Health Breast Center. He said that blood-based markers are the key to better understanding the biology of breast cancer subtypes. Specifically, circulating tumor DNA is one of the more prominent ways to measure tumor burden and detect potentially targetable mutations in a patient's disease. Listen on to hear Burkard discuss the significance of utilizing markers such as alterations in NTRK, PIK3CA, AKT, and ESR1 in the blood and highlight emerging actionable mutations in breast cancer.
There are all kinds of blood markers, and I can talk about what they are, but tonight I'm going to spend most of the time talking about circulating DNA that comes from tumors. And this is of interest because it's a way of doing a simple blood test to find both get a sense of how much tumor burden is in a person, especially with metastatic disease, but other areas as well. And also, it can tell you what particular genetic characteristics that tumor has. And so that can be very helpful for specific selection of treatments. In terms of measuring residual tumor burden, one area where that comes in useful is people with triple negative breast cancer. We know that when we treat them with neoadjuvant chemotherapy, we can get a sense of how well that worked and whether it might have eliminated their tumors based on the response in the surgical sample after this chemotherapy. And so there are standard ways to assay that. But in patients who fail to have a good response, there's some recent data from the group at Indiana University suggesting that you can also stratify them into those who are most likely to have recurrent breast cancer by doing blood biomarkers. And in patients who have a high level of circulating tumor DNA from in their blood, those are the ones who are most likely to have cancer return. So that's a nice way of potentially better identifying those patients who would benefit from more therapy. So, for example, that's one particular use there. Another use in the metastatic setting would be for using genomic or precision oncology. We're often, more and more in breast cancer, we're selecting therapies based on the genes in the patient's tumors. In the past, we focused on ERPR and HER2 exclusively, but more and more we know that patients who have BRCA mutations can benefit from PARP inhibitors. We know there are very rare patient cohorts who can get FDA-approved drugs for very rare genomic translocations of the TRK, A, B, and C genes, or who have microsatellite instability. And today, we were just hearing about, for example, the new evidence that a PI3 kinase inhibitor may be useful in patients with PI3 kinase mutant breast cancer. And so usually, the way we figure out if a patient has that by biopsying a tumor and then looking at the DNA in the tumor, which is the most straightforward way. In many of our patients, especially of those with ER-positive breast cancer, that's not feasible. Because they have maybe bone-only disease or the metastatic tumors are at inaccessible sites. And so cell-free DNA is one way to get at what the genes are in the patient's tumors and maybe a very simple way to assess that and select the best drug. So it's a good adjunct for patients with metastatic breast cancer who you want to take a precision medicine approach. Almost every breast cancer is unique in its genetic characteristics. And this is one of the major challenges that, you know, the most common mutations in breast cancer are PI3 kinase and P53, which happen in up to, depending on what type, up to a quarter of breast cancers. Everything else is less common. There's what we call a long tail. There's a distribution of frequencies from those as the most common mutations to things that you only find mutated in, as we said, 0.1% of breast cancer. And then there's everything in between those extremes. And so one of the challenges is capturing that diversity. So if you want to quantify, for example, the amount of the tumor burden by measuring the DNA in the blood, you have to accept that diversity and accept, I don't even know what mutations I might find in this particular patient, and just try to quantitate the various amount of DNA of each mutation.
Next, we sat down with Yi Chung Cheng, MD, who discussed the optimal incorporation of neoadjuvant and adjuvant data in early stage HER2-positive breast cancer. Given the number of positive trials in recent years, it can be difficult to properly integrate these newer agents and strategies into practice. For starters, data from the Phase 2 NeoSphere trial and Trifana trials served as the basis for the FDA approval of neoadjuvant pertuzumab, trastuzumab, and chemotherapy for patients with node-positive disease who are at high risk or for those with tumors at least 2 centimeters. In our interview, Cheng, an associate professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin, discussed how to use the available data to best optimize outcomes for patients with early-stage HER2-positive disease.
I think the one thing very exciting about HER2-positive breast cancer is we have a lot of trial in a neoadjuvant setting, also adjuvant setting. But the most difficult thing is people do not know how to incorporate all these study results together in practice. I got many calls from community doctors that sometimes they don't know which one should go first or which one come after another one. So I try to see if we can incorporate all this data, and I come up with a summary and see if we can help the community doctor to really utilize all these anti-HER2 therapy treatment. So the two major neoadjuvant trials I want to talk about is the NeoSphere. And the second one is called Trifana. So these are the two neoadjuvant trial established the use of pertuzumab in a neoadjuvant setting. And about the adjuvant trial, I want to focus on three trials. And one is the Affinity. And the second one is Extend-X. And then the last one is the Catherine trial. I think these three trials also give us information about the use of pertuzumab and the Neratinib and also the T-DM1. And as I said last, I will try to incorporate all these results and come up with a kind of like algorithm and a summary and how to use all these drugs. It's difficult because all the trials are not exactly have the same patient population, so it's difficult. But I think we try to look at the best outcome. So I would say, we need to try to do it in a neoadjuvant setting first. I think that is a priority for HER2 positive, is to try to find patients that fit into neoadjuvant setting. And then for those who is not fit into the neoadjuvant setting, then we can move on to the adjuvant setting. And for those who is on neoadjuvant setting, right now we have the Catherine trial that show that if you're not in a complete response, then you have an option of using the T-DM1. Which is actually the first time, because in the past, we only know that if a patient is not in complete response, they have a high risk of recurrence, but we don't know what to do. But at least it's the first time that we know that if they are not in a complete response, we can use a different drug, which is a very exciting. The most important message I want to bring out is really how to combine the current anti-HER2 drug in the clinical practice. Especially, as I've said, we have several trials, very exciting, but they are all in a different setting, different patient population. I think for a community doctor, sometimes it's difficult to really incorporate all these drugs together, and I'm trying to bring the message is how to combine them together or how to use it in a clinical setting.
Our chair of this event was none other than Ruth O'Regan, MD, who told us about several genomic assays and corresponding data sets that can be used to assess the risk of recurrence for a patient with early-stage HR-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer and their need for chemotherapy or endocrine therapy alone. The challenge, said O'Regan, is that because many of these data fall short in terms of extended endocrine therapy and those with node-positive disease, caution should be used when it comes to higher-risk patients until those results read out. Listen on to hear O'Regan, a professor of medicine in the Hematology-Oncology Division at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health and Carbone Cancer Center, highlight current approaches to treatment escalation and de-escalation, and shed light on the use of retrospective molecular profiling, which may help address some unanswered questions in the field.
I spoke about advances for early-stage ER-positive breast cancer and specifically how we can really tailor therapy and give patients the therapy they need and not the therapy they don't need. The use of genomic subtyping in early-stage ER-positive breast cancer has really allowed us to make much more robust decisions for our patients. So the TAILOR-X study, which obviously looked at prospectively at the 21 gene recurrence score, was able to show that up to scores of 25 for recurrence scores, there was absolutely no benefit for chemotherapy in patients overall in the study, which obviously is a huge advance. They did notice, however, that in women under the age of 50, that there was some benefit, particularly when you got up to scores between 16 and 25. So the higher the score, the greater the benefit of chemotherapy for those patients. I think the question in those patients really is, do they all need chemotherapy, or could some of those patients get away with ovarian suppression, given that only about 15% of patients on the TAILOR-X study actually got ovarian suppression? That would be another way of potentially de-escalating therapy for patients. So overall, it's obviously a huge advance for patients to avoid chemotherapy for these early-stage node-negative ER-positive breast cancers. In support of using ovarian suppression in these patients, there was an analysis from the SOFTEC study basically showing that if you use what's called a composite risk score, which is kind of like the 21 gene recurrence score, you're able to basically risk stratify patients who need ovarian suppression added in with endocrine therapy versus endocrine therapy alone. So I think some molecular profiling from SOFTEC will be very useful to determine which patients really need ovarian suppression. The other big question is what you do with patients with node-positive disease. Obviously, there's some prospective data from the MINDAC study basically showing that you can predict prognosis for patients with N1 disease using the 70-gene signature. What it didn't tell us for sure is who needed chemotherapy, however, and there is some retrospective data with the 21-gene recurrence score, again, indicating, just like the MINDAC study, that patients who have a low 21 gene recurrence score ought to have a very good prognosis and may not need chemotherapy. But obviously the definitive way of looking at that will be with the responder study, waiting for the results of that, which we don't have yet. I think the other big question for early stage ER positive disease is how long you need to give treatment for. So there is pretty robust data basically saying that 10 years of tamoxifen is superior to 5 years of tamoxifen, but the data is much more murky when you look at aromatase inhibitors. This is a very important question because we know there are patients that have late recurrences from their ER-positive disease, so if we knew who these patients were, these would be the patients that we could focus on maybe optimizing therapy with longer therapy or perhaps more aggressive therapy up front, either with the addition of ovarian suppression or maybe with the addition of some of the newer agents like the CDK inhibitor. So I think there's a lot of work to be looked at in that setting as well. As far as who needs extended therapy, I think it's an important question because there is toxicity, increased toxicity with longer therapy. There is some data with molecular profiling that may be able to help us going forward to determine which patients need longer treatment. So there's about six different assays that have been looked at in that setting. So I think the key take-home points are we've made huge strides in avoiding chemotherapy for patients with ER-positive early-stage breast cancer. The questions do remain about how to manage patients with node-positive disease and also whether patients can get away with ovarian suppression rather than chemotherapy if they're premenopausal, and then who really needs longer durations of endocrine therapy.
Moving on to advanced HR-positive disease, we spoke with Christopher R. Chittenbar, MD, who explained that treatment for patients with metastatic HR-positive HER2-negative breast cancer depended on blocking the estrogen receptor until research showed that cancer proliferation was possible independent of the ER. The most well-known mechanism that has borne clinical utility is the cyclin D cell signaling pathway, and research exploring this pathway has led to the development of the three FDA-approved CDK4/6 inhibitors, palbociclib, ribociclib, and abemaciclib. There has also been a development in the form of the first FDA-approved PI3 kinase inhibitor, alpelisib, for use in combination with fulvestrant as a treatment for postmenopausal patients with PIK3CA-mutated advanced breast cancer after progression on or after an endocrine-based regimen. Chittenbar, professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin, discussed the research that led to the explosion of these agents in this breast cancer setting.
So for several decades, we've been aware of the role of the estrogen receptor and estrogen in stimulating breast cancer cells. And really, it's the stimulus, it's the switch or the fertilizer that feeds breast cancer. So we've known for some time that estrogen blockade of its interaction with its receptor or lowering the level of estrogen in the body or degrading the receptor was the primary strategy for us using specific drugs such as tamoxifen, the aromatase inhibitors, or fulvestrant to degrade the estrogen receptor. And that's been the mainstay of our treatment for many decades. However, many patients will escape this blockade and have their tumors grow. And with that has come more recently intense research into other mechanisms that might be turning on either through the estrogen receptor or other signaling mechanisms and modifiers of estrogen receptor positive breast cancer proliferation. And we know that the receptors may be activated independent of estrogen through other pathways such as HER2, such as insulin-like growth factor and other factors that might stimulate it. So that's one outside. There may be mutations in the receptor. There may be other pathways downstream that subsequently get turned on that completely bypass that. And then all cells that are dividing and proliferating have to go through a cell cycle. And there we've learned that one of the targets called cyclin D may be increased or may be hyperactivated in proliferating cells, particularly in breast cancer. So with that background, there's been a lot of preclinical research looking at drugs that have that target the cell cycle and the basis for that, and at the same time, drugs that might turn off these pathways. Now, we have really two main categories that are evolving. The one is the CDK4/6 inhibitors, which block cell cycle, which block the cell cycle. And we actually have a Rich's situation where we have now not one, not two, but three chemically different. Clinically, we have three of them that are out there. One is palbociclib, which was the first one on the block. And then we have ribociclib. And then we have, more recently, abemaciclib. And each one of these seem to be equal when it comes to anti-tumor activity. The first trial that came through and tested this hypothesis that was generated by animal and cell culture studies with palbociclib. And under the Paloma studies, which were 1, 2, and 3, which really paired these, and what the preclinical studies showed that when you took one of the CDK4/6 inhibitors, specifically palbociclib in this case, and combined it with an anti-estrogen therapy, that you got synergy and tumors that were formerly resistant to anti-estrogen therapy now became sensitive. So you were in effect bypassing drug resistance or anti-estrogen blockade. And that was very exciting. This was rapidly translated to the clinical trials pairing Paloma 1, 2, and 3 in various settings where they were used as first line for metastatic or even after prior failures in the metastatic setting. and the combinations were done with the non-steroidal aromatase inhibitors, i.e. anastrozole or letrozole and plus palbo. And all of these studies, carefully designed studies in which they were placebo controlled, so you had the pairing of an anti-estrogen plus palbociclib, or you had palbociclib plus a placebo, all showed superiority in prolongation of disease-free survival. And no matter which way you looked at it, next in line came the Mona Lisa trials, which was specifically the design and the graph. The figures look very similar in that they were consistently showing there where you use ribociclib plus an anti-estrogen, you actually, again, saw a prolongation of disease-free survival. And then with the same with abemaciclib. These studies differ somewhat in the timing, whether they're first line or second line therapies, but in all of them, the figures or the results show a similar benefit when you take a CDK4/6 inhibitor.
Finally, Carrie B. Wyszynski, MD, an associate professor of medical oncologist at the University of Wisconsin-Carbone Cancer Center, shed light on the emergence of novel agents in the treatment of patients with metastatic triple-negative breast cancer and how they have led to a greater understanding of how to address the heterogeneity of the disease. For example, prior to the Phase 3 IMpassion 130 trial, the viability of immunotherapy in breast cancer seemed far off following single-agent trials, explained Wyszynski. However, by combining chemotherapy with immunotherapy in the frontline setting, in this case, nab-paclitaxel with atezolizumab, investigators observed a 9.5-month improvement in overall survival versus nab-paclitaxel alone. Subsequently, the combination became the first immunotherapy regimen to receive regulatory approval in breast cancer, and it's indicated as frontline therapy in treatment-naive patients with at least 1% staining of PD-L1 on immune cells.
I think that we are learning that triple-negative breast cancer is really a basket term for multiple different types of cancer. And I think that we're starting to see at least some emergence of different targeted targeted approaches that maybe can pinpoint some of those subtypes of triple negative breast cancer. So I think first we've seen now for about 2 years the emergence of the PARP inhibitors. And we know that there is a group of women with triple negative breast cancers that have BRCA mutant disease or mutation carriers. And that for those group of women, that there is a role for PARP inhibition, so oral PARP inhibitors, either olaparib or talazoparib, in the treatment of their disease. In addition, I think that we've started to see some additional target therapies emerge. So for example, this year we saw the results of the IMpassion 130 data with immunotherapy, the first positive study in breast cancer with immunotherapy. And so this is a combination of atezolizumab with nab-paclitaxel. And the first-line treatment for metastatic triple-negative breast cancer. And really what we saw in that study is that there did seem to be some benefit in terms of the combination, and in particular in the PD-L1 positive cohort, so those patients that had increased PD-L1 in the immune cells in their tumor infiltrate. I think we definitely are in a better place than we were 5 years ago, and I think we'll be in a better place in 5 years. I think we are continuously learning about this type of breast cancer and how we might target it better. One of the other agents that I'm going to talk about tonight are the AKT inhibitors and agents targeting the PI3 kinase pathway in general. And there's been some interesting preliminary data also with those agents in combination with chemotherapy, but in tumors that have molecular alterations in the PI3 kinase pathway. So I think thematically we're seeing improved treatments as long as we can identify which subgroup of patients will benefit from them. And so I think that that's really the next steps, or the current steps and the next steps for triple-negative breast cancer.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to OncLive On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have several upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you'd like to learn more about the treatment advances made in genitourinary cancers, consider registering for the October 22nd State of the Science Summit in Phoenix, Arizona. For those based in White Plains, New York, consider registering for the October 23rd State of the Science Summit on Breast Cancer. Register now at onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit. and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.